You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. And with me tonight, I have Dr. Arjun Makajani, the author of Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Rob.
So I am looking at your curriculum vitae. How do you pronounce that anyway? I've never learned that. Curriculum vitae? Or?
I always say vita in the singular.
Okay.
So I guess if it's one CD, it would be curriculum vita, and plural would be vitae, I guess.
Okay. Well, it's just for you, so I guess it's Vita.
Yes.
And it looks like you earned your Ph.D. in 1972 from University of California.
Right, at Berkeley, yeah.
Yeah, what was your field of study there?
I studied nuclear fusion, so I was at the junction of three different disciplines of physics, which was plasma physics, which is the basic physics that goes into fusion. And then electrical engineering, because we're all trying to make a fusion reactor that would generate electricity. And, of course, nuclear engineering, which is what this particular type of electrical generator would have been like, nuclear fusion. So, but I did my doctorate from the electrical engineering department.
Okay. I'm looking through your... excuse me. I have a... I've been suffering with allergies for the last month and a half, so I may have to excuse myself for a cough now and again. I'm looking at your employment and other experience, and I wanted to kind of figure out where in your experience did you start to become a strong opponent of nuclear fission as opposed to fusion?
Yeah, well, I worked in industry before I went to Berkeley after I finished my master's. I was an engineer in Kaiser Engineers and helped design heavy industry, cement plants, things like that, iron ore processing facilities, and two uranium mills as well. Now, this was before environmental consciousness hit in the form of the National Environmental Policy Act and so on. And when I went to Berkeley, there was a professor passed away not long ago, but a really eminent nuclear engineering professor, Professor Thomas Pigford. He was a brilliant, brilliant man, and he came to give a lecture about energy in the energy seminar in the EE department at Berkeley. And he laid out the disadvantages of nuclear energy, starting with uranium mining and milling. And I was shocked at myself that I had turned off my mind 8:30 to 5 at work, because I remembered we had no instrumentation for radiation that I remembered wiring up. You know, I was one of the engineers that was responsible for making sure that everything that was designed had an electric, had a stop-start button, had a wires going to it, and that would actually start up. And we didn't worry about the radium in the tailings ponds. And in fact, there was nothing in the design specification that talked about these things, and it wasn't required at the time. And I thought, and then Professor Pigford talked about coal, and he said coal is much worse than nuclear, and so we should build 1,000 nuclear power plants. That was the bottom line. And I said, why build 1,000 nuclear power plants? Why do we need so much electricity? And between the best and the brightest were in that room. This was the advanced energy seminar at Berkeley. Nobody seemed to know. So as penance, I decided to do the first energy efficiency study, research, which turned out to be the first energy efficiency study. I was the principal author of it when it was published a year later. and I showed that you could do everything that we were doing then and have the same economic output with 40% less energy. It was very unusual, even radical at the time as a technical idea. And I never kind of looked back from that. I thought that we could do energy better. And by the time I finished, not many people knew anything about energy efficiency in terms of actually hard numbers. And I gravitated to a job in that, a Ford Foundation energy policy project, and then went from there. And then the more I learned about it, the more I thought making plutonium to boil water, not a very good idea. And then when I researched how nuclear power came about, that too cheap to meter was actually a deception, because every study that was done in the 50s, at the time when the public was being told it would be too cheap to meter, by the establishment, by academia, by industry, and by the Atomic Energy Commission, concluded that nuclear power would be expensive, and in most cases that it would be more expensive than coal, which was the alternative at the time.
Well, I've got a beg to differ. I'm not sure I understand why people believe there was some sort of advertising campaign claiming that nuclear would be too cheap to meter. There was a speech, a visionary speech by Louis Strauss, who was the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission back in 1954, and he was proposing visions of being able to sail across the ocean on very little fuel and curing all diseases and all kinds of stuff. And he included in that comment, and perhaps by the time your children are in your children's lifetime, they may see electricity that is too cheap to meter.
Right.
A lot of people who, and actually I've been contacted by one of Strauss's grandsons, and he said that when he talked about that, he was envisioning nuclear fusion as what would be available in their children's lifetime. And I wrote a paper on this about 2005. Uh-huh. I'm 52 years old, but my father was an adult, was 25 years old at the time that Louis Strauss was making that prediction. So his children's lifetime, I think we still got another 35 or 40 years to go before the end of that. I'm hoping that
before
I'm still alive.
It's never going to be too cheap to meter. Knew that at the time. I've researched this, and I've read the speech as well, and I wrote a book, co-authored a book called Nuclear Power Deception, in which the history of that, it wasn't an isolated remark. So I wanted to know where did it come from and why was it said and what was the context of it. And the context of it in 1954 was a propaganda campaign by the United States about nuclear power. And propaganda was a word that was used by the Atomic Energy Commissioner, Mr. Murray, at the time. It's not something I'm putting in somebody's mouth. The context was the Atoms for Peace speech. When President Eisenhower wanted to make a speech about thermonuclear weapons before the United Nations and he saw a draft, he got very depressed and he said, I don't want to make a depressing speech about, blowing how the world might blow up. Give me something positive to say. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing. The details are in my book. I'd be happy to send you a complimentary copy.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of an Eisenhower fan myself, so I just finished a recent biography of Eisenhower.
Right.
In my opinion, he was probably one of the most effective presidents we had during the entire 20th century, and part of that was because of his very deep understanding of what it takes to make the world go round. And he thoroughly believed that we needed to turn the very strong power of the atom into something that would actually make the world go round and provide power to places that had no power and displace the use of fossil fuels in places where, we were very vulnerable. I mean, Eisenhower experienced such things as the Suez Canal crisis in 1956 and had people who were very dependent on fossil fuels from the Middle East you know, basically trying to tell him how to run the world. He was the guy who sent over an emissary to the King Saud in 1956 and said, King, you better, you know, pull in your folks and help them understand that if you're not careful, we're going to replace oil by unleashing this thing called atomic fission and helping it become commercially viable in competition with your product.
Now, you know, I'm not going to comment on, you know, the quality of Eisenhower's presidency because I'm not that well studied in it. Certainly he has accomplished some great things and probably did some things that were not so advisable, like the sponsored coup in Iran in 1953 that led to some pretty bad, led to a pretty bad end, for which the globe is still suffering some consequences. The CIA-sponsored coup in Guatemala that led to a lot of bloodshed, for which President Clinton apologized in the 1990s. So all presidents, it's in the in my view, it's in the nature of the position that when you get there, you're going to do some good things and some not so good things. It's true of all of us in our own lives. So I'm not pointing fingers at Eisenhower or anybody else. All I'm saying is that when he wanted to make a speech about thermonuclear weapons, he asked for something more positive to say. To my knowledge, there was not a deep analysis behind suggesting atoms for peace, because since 1946, every single study that had been done had showed that nuclear power would be very expensive. In fact, President Truman's appointed committee on energy and materials called the Paley Commission, I think that was the CBS Energy's Paley, later CBS Energy's Paley, looked into energy and material security issues. And they actually thought that nuclear was not promising and that the United States wanted, and they actually forecast an oil crisis in 20 years if the United States didn't attend to its energy future, because the U.S. was becoming an oil importer quite rapidly. Mm-hmm. And they actually thought that we should be developing solar energy. And so whether you think they were right or wrong, I don't believe, and when you look at the question of nuclear, a nuclear reactor, let's look at the technical things and get away from political things for a minute. A nuclear reactor is just a boiler.
Well, it is a boiler, but don't forget that we burn about 6 billion tons of coal a year, mostly to boil water.
Okay. I mean, let me actually finish a thought to explain something, or maybe you want to interview somebody else. I don't know. A nuclear reactor is just a boiler. I do understand that it replaces a lot of coal with a very small amount of fuel. I understand that. I know that. I've studied these issues for quite a long time. But it's only the place that makes steam. Most of the costs of the electricity in your house are downstream of the boiler. They are in the turbine generator set. They are in the switch yards. They are in the transmission system and in the distribution system. About 80% of the costs in the electricity that you consume in your house, now that's not true of industry. In industry, the bigger proportion of the costs in the generating station. But in your home, 80% of the costs of electricity, even if the boiler and fuel were completely free, would be downstream of that. So even in principle, it could never be too cheap to meter.
Well,
so
can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question based on that? You know, you've got to let me have time to converse as well.
Sure, absolutely.
One of the industries that gets compared against the nuclear industry is telecommunications, where there is a tremendous infrastructure cost, but once you've made the investment in the infrastructure, the cost of each additional phone call is dropping dramatically to the point where most of us now buy too cheap to meter telecommunications. We pay a fixed fee every month and make as many calls as we want.
Right.
So we don't really meter the calls anymore. We simply pay our monthly bill to pay for the infrastructure that was required to get us that ability to make inexpensive, marginal cost phone calls.
Yeah, now this is to some extent true of the boiler piece. So if we focus on the boiler, it's true that in that sense, a nuclear reactor is not like, really free call. But if you take the cost of a nuclear reactor and energy, electricity from a nuclear reactor at the bus bar, 10, 12 cents a kilowatt hour, 12 cents a kilowatt hour today from a new reactor, 2 cents of that would be...
Well, we don't have any new reactors, so why are you
using
that cost?
Yeah, I mean, in the projected cost, as they are projected currently, like the reactors that were currently licensed to be built in Georgia and their estimates are $14 billion, or the reactors that are proposed to be built in Florida. So, or you can take the older reactors and bring them up to present-day costs in $2010. Dollars. They won't be that different. About 80% of the cost is in the reactor, capital cost. So once you build it, I'm agreeing with you, actually. And a small amount of cost, 2 cents a kilowatt hour in the running cost. The average is actually a little bit less today. About a third of that is fuel, and two-thirds of that is the personnel operating, security guards, operators, diesel, hydrogen, all the things that you need to run the plant. And so in that sense, it's right. But what I said is, even if the reactor is free, which it is not, it's a more expensive boiler than the other kind, what you're doing is you're trading off cheap fuel, which is nuclear fuel, against coal, which is more expensive fuel. But the boiler is more expensive. So you have no a priori reason to expect that this particular machine is ever going to generate electricity that would be cheaper than coal, leaving aside what are called environmental externalities. General Electric engineers at the time said that there were guffaws in General Electric when people suggested that this was somehow going to solve the problems of man, whatever that might be. I can find the exact quote for you, actually, if I could lay my hands on a copy of my book. But I'll send it to you and you can read it for yourself. So I'm not inventing these opinions about what was going on then, sitting here passing judgment on Louis Strauss or what he said. It was, Adams for Peace was an idea to convince other countries to not make bombs, and that we will promise you this wonderful energy source that's going to solve your energy problems. And there was an 18-month campaign that was described at the time as a propaganda campaign. Now, there's actually a whole book about Eisenhower and his public relations ideas, and I actually don't remember the name of the book, but it's a very, very interesting book, and he was apparently very, very good at that. And part of Japan's overcoming their nuclear allergy and going to build nuclear reactors happened in the aftermath of the Adams for Peace speech. Now, not everybody needed it to do that. The Indians have already embarked on their own, but it resulted in assistance to others to build nuclear reactors. I don't know. We were going to talk about thorium energy, but we can talk about nuclear energy in general. I personally do not believe that at any time, I have at least never seen any sensible technical calculation done by anybody that suggested that nuclear energy would be cheap, much less too cheap to meter. In my children's time or your children's time or anybody's grandchildren's time, it's not going to happen.
Well, let me, first of all, there's a few things that your analysis overlooks. Yes, I agree, and the history is very clear that in 1960s all the way up until about 1973, when people said that nuclear would be cheaper than fossil fuels, there were guffaws. But something happened in 1973 that changed the equation dramatically. Because in 1973, you could buy oil for $2 or $3 per barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, by 1974, it was $12 per barrel. And the economics changed dramatically. And coal prices also started to rise. Now, the other issue is today, most people would not say that the alternative to nuclear is coal. They would say the alternative to nuclear is natural gas.
Right. I think that among the fossil fuels, that's reasonably clear.
Well, among any reliable energy source that can be turned on or turned off or adjusted by either an automatic control system or an operator.
Well, you know, this is so we can go off on a different direction. The idea that you should have all dispatchable energy sources, the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, John Wellinghoff, has said more than once that the idea of baseload power, that we may need coal or nuclear or natural gas for that instance in a baseload mode for that matter in a baseload mode, essentially belongs in the 20th century, in the age of punch cards and mainframes. We have technology to deal with all of these things. It's not going to happen overnight, but I wrote a book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, so I'm accumulating my book debts to you. I'd be happy to send you a copy of that, too.
I've read both of your books, by the way.
Okay, so I don't need to send you a copy. So you know that the things that I have said are pretty well documented.
Well,
I started.
I would like to ask, what technical background does John Wellinghoff have with regard to operating any kind of power grid? As I understand his
oversees the U.S. power grid.
He's a lawyer.
His job.
He's a lawyer. Appointed by a politician. What does that mean?
What background did Eisenhower have to make judgments about nuclear energy? When you're in an executive position, it's your job to understand these things sufficiently to be able to make reliable public pronouncements about them. I'm not relying on Wellinghoff for what I'm saying. I came to my own conclusion. I'm just giving you an idea that baseload. I started out my research on carbon-free, nuclear-free, not thinking, as you know, if you read my book, not thinking that you could actually achieve a renewable energy economy economically for precisely this reason, that I didn't think that we could foresee a system in which you could overcome the effects of intermittency at reasonable cost. Not too cheap to meter, but at reasonable cost, at overall cost of energy services that would not be different than what we pay today. So if you do energy efficiency first and you have a proper mix of energy sources, then I think you can actually achieve a fully renewable energy system. You won't have to worry as an individual whether your lights will come on or off depending on whether the wind is blowing or the sun is shining.
Well, let me ask you, I've read your book, and one of the things that it starts off with is not only conservation, but something that is referred to as demand management, which in my book means turning off your customers, regardless of whether they want to be turned off or not.
Well, actually not. I didn't actually talk a whole lot about demand management and carbon-free, nuclear-free. I feel I should have talked more about it, but since I certainly have. Demand management can mean a lot of different things. So it can mean like what I do with my contract with my electric utility. I allow them at most a dozen times a year to turn off my air conditioner for a couple of hours a day on the hottest days. So that's actually curtailment of service. However, there are lots of ways of demand management in an intelligent grid, and that's why I said today we can do it. 30 years ago, I don't think it would have been possible. Today, you can build a refrigerator that can talk to the utility. Do you care when the defrost cycle in your freezer is operating? You don't. You don't know when it happens. I don't know when it happens, and I don't care when it happens. If I set a dishwasher to operate now, unless I'm having a party and want to override the dishwasher from operating when there's plenty of wind, I don't care when the dishwasher operates, or the clothes washing machine operates. So you can have an intelligent grid without any curtailment of service at reasonable cost. Do we have it today? No. Today, the total amount of communication between consumers and producers, as represented by our on-off switches, and each on-off switch is, of course, just one bit of information, by my back of the envelope calculation is about 10 gigabytes. We have about 10 billion on-off switches, very rough numbers in the system. The amount of information that would fit on a $10 or $15 flash drive. That's how much or how little communication we have. Now, of course, there's a lot of internal smartness in the grid in terms of managing the electricity flows in the transmission system. But there's not a whole lot between consumers and producers. And demand management does not... My laptop is plugged in most of the time when I'm at work, as it is now, or when I'm at home. So the battery is 100% charged essentially all the time. I don't care if the battery gets 10%. If the power to my laptop gets cut off so the battery goes to 90% and I get cheaper electricity, I don't. But today I can't do that because we don't have the technical systems installed, but it's going to happen in the next 10 years.
Well, you speak as if all of the power going to the grid goes to individual consumers. I used to run a small factory, and our number one and number two employees were Florida Power Corporation because we produced plastic products. And it wasn't a very large factory. We employed about 20 people. But our electricity bill, and we had two different services coming so that we had more reliable power, was $4,000 and $5,000 per month. So a total of $9,000 per month. And it was very important to us, though, to have that power, because without it, we could do nothing.
Right.
All of our employees would be completely unproductive if we lost power for even just a few minutes, because
right.
it would take another hour to stabilize our machines.
I have worked in industry, actually, in a chemical factory, and I know that if we lost power for 30 seconds, the whole place would be down for days. Because you couldn't just flip the switches back on. It was a whole process, and I actually was responsible for. We were at a factory in a lightning alley. I was responsible for negotiating with a utility to protect its transmission lines better from lightning, so we didn't get cut off so many times. So there are places in the power system where you cannot afford power to go off, and where the penalties are very large. And today, actually, I'm an advocate of having a distributed grid, which would be much more reliable. You know, after Fukushima, before Fukushima, of course, there was before the accident, there was the tsunami, which was very, very devastating. And the port of Sendai, where the tsunami hit, got completely wiped out. Its whole electricity system got completely wiped out. But there was one place where the utility was doing an experiment at the university there. I think it's called Tohoku Fukushi University. I haven't researched it a whole lot yet. I've just read a little bit about it, where the utility and the university were experimenting with a microgrid. So they had a diversity. They had diesels. They had fuel cells. I think they had solar. They had some storage devices. Normally, they operated with the grid. They were making measurements as to how a microgrid can operate with a macro grid. But when the Sendai got wiped out in the tsunami, everybody lost electricity for a very prolonged period of time, of course, except the university did not lose power even for 1 minute. You know, here in the East, I don't know where you live, but in the East, in 2003, we had that fantastic blackout where 50 million people lost power because there was a problem in an interchange near Cleveland. We're susceptible to that kind of disruption. And I think if we had a better grid, a more distributed sources, Virginia Power here or some power company, maybe in West Virginia, installed sodium sulfur batteries on the consumer side of the substation because they thought, you know, a lot of people have solar PV on their rooftops and maybe we ought to manage this better. But they found that the advantages of having a storage system on the consumer side of the substation are many. You can defer investments in the distribution system when there's new construction because now you can manage it from the consumer side of the substation rather than from the central station power plant. So today's technology actually, I mean, 30 years ago, you couldn't connect millions of households with PV on their rooftops sensibly and economically to a grid. Today, we're headed in a direction that can do that. I mean, I've attended a workshop or seminar on where Germany is headed, you know, and maybe the Germans know something we don't know. They are going to have a fully renewable energy system, electricity system by 2050. That is their goal. And as you know, they're going to shut down their nuclear power plants by 2022. Mm-hmm. And their CO2 emissions went up somewhat last year, right after they shut down 8 of them. But by the end of the year, they were exporting electricity again. Their prices were headed downward, and their CO2 emissions are headed downward, too. That is because even though they are a pretty damp, cloudy country, you know, solar PV costs half in Germany of the average cost of the United States. And I think volume is a large part of the answer today, even though their labor costs are comparable and everything else is comparable. So,
I'm curious about that because I thought the feed-in tariff in Germany was considerably higher than any retail price of electricity here in the United States.
Well, the actual cost of electricity in Germany, so this is something that has fascinated me just in the last few weeks, Rod. I've been shocked to discover what's staring you in the face and that you don't know, even though you're in the business. So at first I compared California bills with San Antonio, and I found even though California rates are 50% bigger, the overall bills are lower. And then, you know, the question came up, who's got air conditioning, who doesn't, and so on. And we have some colleagues in Germany that run an institute there, and I learned that German electricity rates, prices, are much higher. Their average residential rate is 3 times what it is here. And of course, they're not running out of house, you know, bankrupting their, emptying their bank accounts, paying for electricity. So I called up my friend, who's also in the business, and said, you know, send me some data. And I was surprised to learn that the average cost of residential electricity in Germany, the bill, the annual bill of what they pay, is less than the annual bill in the United States, even though their cost is 3 times as high, is because they're so much more efficient in everything.
Well,
efficiency is truly the key.
Well, I've been in homes in Germany. I know what I live in, and I would not want to live in a German home. My electric bill is, let's see, I'm running about 2,000 kilowatt hours per month in my home. And I don't live in a huge house, but I live in a house that has lots of windows. I look out on the Blue Ridge Mountains, and it's the temperate climate here is not cloudy and cool. It's pretty darn hot during the summertime.
Yeah.
So
I live in a house, I don't know how big your house is, but I live in a very comfortable house with 4 or 5 bedrooms and a family room downstairs and a living room. It's a pretty big house. It's an American house. And lots of windows. I have a nice view also. My consumption is about 7,000 kilowatt hours a year, including half central air conditioning. Of course, we use it maybe differently than you do, and that's a question of personal habit and preference and how we want to relate to the environment. But I live very comfortably, I can assure you. And at my age also, I'm getting on in years, as you can understand. I finished my doctorate in 72, so I like to be comfortable. But my 6.3 kilowatts solar PV on my roof. Now, I need to be connected to the grid to have electricity, 24 hours a day. But it has turned out to be more than enough for our needs.
Yeah, we don't have solar. partly because I haven't wanted to ask my neighbors to pay for my decorations.
Yeah, right. You know, it's a question of how we're going. You are asking your neighbors to pay for your decorations in the form of the Price-Anderson Act. There are lots of subsidies for every particular fuel source. And if you read carbon-free, nuclear-free, as you say you have, you will not find advocacy of any. I am not for energy subsidies. In fact, I think we should get rid of subsidies.
Did you accept a subsidy for your solar system?
No. I didn't install solar for a very long time. So Mr. Buffett isn't going to pay. So let's take how subsidies and taxes work. If I have low taxes in a high income bracket, like Mr. Buffett, I'm not going to pay more taxes because it's not going to solve the problem of the country. I'm going to pay the taxes that are due, as you do. You take all the tax deductions you can get. You take your mortgage tax deduction, for example. And so the renters are subsidizing you. So you are asking your neighbors, I presume that you had a mortgage on your house, and the people who are low income in rented houses were subsidizing you.
Interest payment on my house does not qualify me for a mortgage deduction. It is below my standard deduction. And for the 8 years before I moved here, I was a renter.
Yeah. So, well, maybe you're the perfect exception. But in the normal circumstances, there's a lot of give and take on an individual level that happens. I don't particularly care for subsidies. I'd rather that we didn't have subsidies or the kind of tax code we have. I think we should have a much fairer tax code. In fact, I've advocated a tax code that would require me to pay more. For instance, I think we should have a flat tax of Social Security on all income. That would require me to pay more Social Security tax than I do today. But I think it would be a lot fairer because I think working people could see a decrease in their Social Security taxes. Yep. But it doesn't solve any problem if I pay Social Security tax on all income as a kind of a gift to the federal government. It doesn't solve any particular problem. So
let's bring the conversation back to energy. I'm curious about the amount of money that the Price-Anderson Act has cost the American taxpayers in the 50 years that it's been in effect.
The Price-Anderson Act is an insurance policy. It's actually not even an insurance policy. And the amount of money, you know, now I hope that we don't have an accident like Fukushima. But if we ever do, the amount of money, we can get an inference from what the Japanese will be going through. We don't know exactly what the cost of Fukushima is going to be. But they had U.S.-designed reactors. Until Fukushima happened, everybody said it couldn't happen in the West. It was the Chernobyl and, you know, the Soviets and the poor reactor designs. And there was a lot of truth to a lot of that. But now that an accident happened in the West, we say, well, it won't happen here. I can tell you what the worst-case accident estimates are here in the United States, say published by Brookhaven National Lab. Say the worst-case spent fuel pool accident in a closed reactor in a densely populated area was estimated by Brookhaven in 1997 to be north of $500 billion, which would be about $700 billion in today's dollars. And that's a Brookhaven National Lab study. There's no insurance premium on that. There's actually no insurance premium even on the $12 billion that the utilities are obliged to pay in case of an accident. They just are obliged to pony up $100 million in per reactor or some $100 million change.
Well, they do pay for insurance. Up to,
they buy some individual insurance up to
$300 million.
Some amount of money per reactor, and then if an accident costs more than that, then all the utilities are obliged to chip in. And then above 12.6, I think, is where it stands now. The taxpayer is supposed to jump in, although there's no provision for that. As in Japan, there was no fund over there to take care of Fukushima. And what is happening in Japan is exactly what would happen here, is the public would take all of those liabilities. Now, I work every day for nuclear safety, because I know, even though I don't like nuclear power particularly, or at all, we do have it. And even if we stopped all the reactors, we'd still have spent fuel pool safety problems for decades to come. So we actually need to make sure we won't have an accident. We need safety systems here that are very rigorous, and we need a real regulatory system that's actually attending to all of these things.
So what would happen to a spent fuel pool that has, say, fuel that's been out of the reactor for 18 months and the water suddenly disappeared from the spent fuel pool?
Well, it would depend. If you read the Brookhaven report, you'll see that there's a whole range of outcomes with accidents, damages in the event of a fire ranging from under $1 billion to, as I said,
well, how would the fire start?
$1 billion.
How would the fire start?
How the fire starts when the water is drained and there's some very hot fuel in it. Now, you know, if all the fuel is very cool and the fuel is very separated, which is what we've been advocating, then you probably won't have a fire and you won't have severe consequences. But if we have spent fuel pools like Vermont Yankee, which has 40 years worth of spent fuel jammed into one spent fuel pool, more spent fuel than all the four Fukushima-stricken reactors put together, and you're putting hot and spent fuel in it when you withdraw it, if you have an accident close to that time or a terrorist attack, you could have a pretty devastating fire.
Like I said, if none of the fuel's been in a reactor in the last 18 months, the heat generation, no matter how densely packed it is, because it can't get any more densely packed than rods next to each other, is only about, well, 7 watts or so, 17 watts or so per rod. So you can't get to temperatures necessary to cause any kind of damage, even if the pool is dry. And I've got a group of qualified nuclear engineers who've run the numbers, done the models, and the Brookhaven study was based on a lot of assumptions, like how much material is in the pool, and if it suddenly went airborne, what would that cause? Well, before you can do that, you have to have a mechanism for it going airborne.
Well, actually, there's new reg 1738, I think. New reg 1738, which describes the mechanism for spent fuel pool accidents that would result in fires. And this is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's risk assessment document. And, of course, there are lots of scenarios where you don't get fires. But, you know, you're not always 18 months away from unloading spent fuel pools. That's sort of the extreme case, right, when you're at the end of your fuel cycle before you have refueled. But sometimes you're also in the beginning of a refueling cycle when you've just unloaded spent fuel in the pool.
Yeah, but you mentioned that if we shut down all the reactors, we'd have a decades-long problem. If we shut down all the reactors, we'd have a...
Well, we have a decades-long problem of... Well, you know, you can have a terrorist attack on a spent fuel pool.
You can have a terrorist attack on a football stadium, too.
Sorry?
I said you can have a terrorist attack on a football stadium,
on a tall
building.
I'm not minimizing that problem. Lots of people worry about it. We've got whole government departments worrying about things like that. You have chemical plants. Nuclear is not the unique risk in this society. It's just the risk that I happen to worry about in my profession.
Yeah, but nobody's talking about shutting down football games. Nobody's talking about eliminating all tall buildings. Nobody's talking about getting rid of the avgas storage at airports, which is, you know, a bomb ready to happen.
I'm not talking about getting rid of spent fuel.
But you're talking about getting rid of nuclear
storage.
Power.
What I have advocated for spent fuel fission
as a power source. That is your mission. Or one of your missions, in
carbon-free,
nuclear-free.
It's not my unique mission. I do lots of different things. I did nuclear disarmament for many years. I'd like to see nuclear weapons gone from the face of the earth. I'm doing renewable energy. I really would love to see a renewable energy system, not only in this country, but elsewhere in the world, because I think it's a more sensible way to make energy.
Is there a single example that you can describe to me of a completely renewable energy system that is at least on the scale of a city in the whole world?
Well, no.
Is there a single example?
Texas has got 10,000 megawatts of wind today.
Right, but Denmark, with lots of fossil fuel.
Germany, it's 20% of its electricity. Germany is a country of 80 million people. It gets 20% of its electricity from renewables. That's like a country of 16 million people.
But that is only 20% of a grid that has lots of
fossil
fuel.
It's going to take some time. So we're starting now to get renewable energy.
We started renewable energy in 1960 or so when people started building solar
panels. It hasn't been economical. Wind energy began its economical curve 15 years ago, and solar PV is only... You should look at the solar PV costs of Germany. 5 years, 6 years ago, in 2006, they were €5 a watt. In December 2011, they were €1.97 a watt. So we are in a time when things are changing very rapidly in renewable energy. There was a reason why 6 years ago I was very, very skeptical that we could do a renewable energy economy, because I was aware of the cost of the time. But when I looked at the direction in which things are going, I changed my mind. Maybe you ought to do that too.
How much does a kilowatt hour
How
much does a kilowatt hour of solar energy cost between the hours of 6 p.m. and 6 a.m.?
That's a silly question.
No, it's not. Because if you don't have something that is carbon-free supplying the power grid during the hours where people are still alive and moving and doing business and running factories and going to discos and all that other stuff,
Let's stop. We're not having a productive conversation that would inform the public. You have read my book. I do address the questions of intermittency there. There are two reports subsequently where we actually took electricity data from a utility in Utah, 8,760 hours a day, and Minnesota, where maybe more people go to discos. Okay. Now, if you don't let me finish, I'm going to hang up, all right? And then we actually did a renewable Minnesota study, which I did a tour of the Midwest just this March or February, something, in which I showed graphs how you could meet the electricity requirements for every hour of the day, including the night when people are going to discos. If you look at the National Renewable Energy Lab, they have a model for how you do baseload wind. Now, if you're not willing to listen to technical information and just go on saying the same things, then it's not a useful conversation to inform the public. But we are in the business of informing the public. If people have criticisms of our reports and the idea that you can supply electricity 24 hours a day, you know, when I did my study in Utah, we had an advisory board. I had the director of the Public Service Commission on my advisory board. I wanted that to happen because I'm not in the business of hornswoggling the public or some ideological agenda. I wanted to make sure that when I said this is what it's going to cost and this is how you overcome the effects of intermittency, that it actually has had some credibility in a very conservative state like Utah. And it was extremely well received when we published the report at the end of 2010. So maybe you ought to take a look at what you do at night when people are going to discos. Well, and some people are trying to worry about how you supply renewable electricity.
Okay, I have an advantage because I have not had a good conversation
because this is an ideological conversation.
Can you explain to people how you do that? I have an advantage. I read your book. Can you explain how you supply electricity at night briefly so that people can learn?
Yes, I can certainly explain it to you. I've already explained it a little bit. You have a smart grid so that your demand is shaped more to the supply, so that even though it won't disrupt anything that you are doing, and it'll be entirely voluntary. That's one way to do it. The other way is to do energy storage. We have compressed air energy storage. The other way is to have what we call natural gas power plants today. So today we would be operating natural gas power plants as we do when wind goes to 10, 15, 20%, what they do in Texas and Denmark or Germany. But eventually you can replace natural gas with biogas. In my book, I talked about getting biofuels from algae. You can get 10,000 gallons of fuel from algae. As I said, this is not all here today. It's going to take some time to develop. But if we don't go in the direction of developing it, we won't get there. And a part of my objective is to try to make sure that we do get there. And, of course, we do efficiency. We reduce the peak. That is the foundation of everything. If we go on with very inefficient use of electricity, then, of course, it becomes much more costly and much more difficult. And we've been very frank about that, too. If you look at our Minnesota study, you'll see it. And whether you go to nuclear or renewables, you pay a lot more for electricity than we do today if we're simply going to generate electricity from new sources in with low CO2 output. It doesn't matter whether you go to nuclear or whether you go to wind. If you do efficiency, you can come out at approximately the same cost as today for energy services. So that's how you do it.
Do you think that there's
There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.